This is Blessed Trails with Belinda Gale on Equestrian Legacy Radio. Heard around the world online at equestrianlegacy.net.
I am so glad our trails have crossed. Oh, the joy you bring to me. And as I look upon each face, such kindness there I see. I wish for you the love of God, a love that never fails. And as we travel life's long path, I wish you blessed go their separate ways, and life goes rolling on. I hope our trails will cross again before God takes us home. We share the wondrous love of God, a love that never fails. And as we travel long path, I wish you blessed trails. Yes, as we travel life's long path, I wish you blessed trails. Blessed trails.
Welcome to Blessed Trails. I am your host, Belinda Gale, and our show features interviews with wonderful guests as well as gospel, inspirational, and patriotic music with a definite Western flair. Today's guest is extra special to me. He is not a musical guest, but his life exemplifies dedication, service, and sacrifice. I feel very honored to have him on the show, but before we introduce him, let's listen to R.W. Hampton's version of Ragged Old Flag.
I walked through a county courthouse square. On a park bench, an old man was sitting there. I said, "Your old courthouse is kind of run down." He said, "No, it'll do for our little town." I said, "Your old flagpole has leaned a little bit, and that's a ragged old flag you got hanging on it." And he said, "Have a seat, son." And I sat down. "Is this the first time you've been to our little town?" I said, "I think it is." He said, "I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag. You see, we got a little hole in that flag there when Washington took it across the Delaware. And it got powder burned the night Francis Scott Key sat watching it, writing, 'Oh, say, can you see?' It got a rip in New Orleans with Pakenham and Jackson tugging at its seams. And it almost fell at the Alamo beside the Texas flag, but she waved on, though. And she got cut with a sword at Chancellorsville, and she got cut again at Shiloh Hill. There was Robert E. Lee and Beauregard and Bragg, and that south wind blew hard on that ragged old flag. On Flanders Field in World War I, she got a big hole from a Bertha gun. She turned blood red in World War II. She hung limp and low a time or two. She was in Korea, Vietnam. She went where she was sent by her Uncle Sam. She waved from our ships upon the briny foam, and now they've about quit waving her back here at home. In her own good land, she's been abused. She's been burned, dishonored, denied, and refused. And the government for which she stands has been scandalized throughout the land. And she's getting threadbare and she's wearing thin, but she's in pretty good shape for the shape she's in. 'Cause she's been through the fire before, and I believe she can take a whole lot more. So we raise her up every morning and we bring her down slow every night. We don't let her touch the ground and we fold her up just right. On second thought, I do like to brag, 'cause I'm mighty proud of that ragged old flag.
Oh, I always love that recitation. And as you can tell, this show is going to have a patriotic kind of a bend to it, and you'll understand more as we get into it. But I can't tell you how excited I am to share today's guest with all of you. He has lived a life of service that is rich and full and multifaceted. He has served his family, his country, his church, his friends, and his community. His pure joy in lifting up and helping others is abundantly evident, and the thread that weaves it all together is his foundational belief in and trust in our Lord. Because of time constraints, we're going to primarily focus on one facet of his life today, but it is a very special one. I am thrilled and immensely honored to welcome to the show my precious husband, Robert Lorbeer. Hey, honey.
Well, hey, honey, yourself. I wasn't expecting hey, honey, but I'm glad to be here. And I tell you, R.W.'s rendition of that song and Johnny Cash's, chokes me up every time I hear that. I love that. It's really, really wonderful.
I do too. And I'm going to offer a disclaimer throughout this show, because I'm probably going to slip into honeys and babes when I'm talking to you. I'll try not to, but I probably will. So I'm just going to get that out of the way right up front. Oh my gosh. So I just want to kind of delve into you know, parts of your life, and really we're going to focus on your military career and you know where that took you, because that's fascinating to me, and I'm very proud of what you have given to our country. And but I would like to lay a little foundation, and let's talk about you growing up in the Midwest.
I grew up in western Kansas in a small town. My father was a school teacher and a coach. Actually, I think that his primary function in life was to be a coach and guide young men in sporting events. And the secondary was teaching. He taught so that he could coach. But we grew up in small towns. I had three sisters and myself. And we were active in our community and active in our church. We attended the Methodist church in all of the towns that we lived in, Moreland and Stockton and Hayes, and Hayes, Kansas. All those towns are in Kansas. And we were very active. You know, it was part of our weekly routine to get dressed up and go to church every Sunday. And we were proud to go. We liked it and enjoyed it. The whole family did, and we were very active, just participating.
That sounds like an idyllic way to grow up. And I know you were very active in sports, because your dad being a coach, that was a big part of your life.
Yes, it was. I played sports year-round, football, basketball, and baseball, and we were always on the go to a sporting event. So, yes.
I remember you telling me that I think your mother wanted you to take piano, and you took like one lesson.
Actually, I took all of two lessons. And then I did learn a couple of songs that I can still play, but I decided that wasn't for me. Regrettably now, as I look back on it, I certainly wish that I had more musical abilities and skills than I do, but I enjoy music a lot, but I never really participated in it as a child, and I wish I had.
I remember you telling me you thought it was too girly. You wanted to do sports, and you looked at it as girly.
Well, yes, that's true. I looked at it as a sissy thing to do, because I wanted to be a sportsman. And my goal at that time in my life was to play professional baseball. That's what I wanted to do, and that's what my dad wanted me to do as well.
Oh, gosh. So you grew up, tell us what kept you from going into professional sports and how your life kind of skewed as you grew up.
Well, I was an excellent sports player in all those sports in western Kansas, but as I moved into a wider arena, I didn't match up to the skill levels of other people. So that took care of my search to be a professional sportsman. So that didn't happen.
And so you went to college, I know, for, was it one semester or 1 year? I don't remember now, before you decided.
I went to college for a year at Fort Hays, Kansas State College, and now university, and played sports there as well. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I had tried to get into the Air Force Academy. The Air Force Academy was just being built when I was a young man in Colorado Springs. And I thought, gosh, I'd watched TV and there was a television show that was called Men of West Point. And it was a weekly show, and I really liked that. And I thought, gosh, I'll go to the Air Force Academy since it's coming online. And I didn't pass the physical. I had broken a vertebrae and a fractured vertebrae in my neck playing football in high school. And so I didn't pass the physical. So I went to college in my hometown, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I decided that I would enlist in the Army. At that time, the draft was on, and I knew eventually that I was going to be drafted. So I decided to enlist in the Army. And one of the few man-to-man talks I had with my dad was on the front porch just the day or so before I left to go into the Army. And he says, you know, I'm not going to tell you not to go in the Army, but I want you to promise me that someday you'll complete your education. And he talked about how important his college education had been to him. And so I promised him that I would. And so since I have gotten a bachelor's and a master's and a doctorate, I think that I fulfilled that commitment that I made to him on my front porch that day.
You did. You definitely did. So you joined the Army as an enlisted man, and you were in the Army. And so tell us how you ended up at West Point.
I was in the Army for as an enlisted man for a couple of years, and went through basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, and then was assigned for advanced training out in Fort Ord, California. And there was a colonel chaplain that was there, and I had mentioned to him that I had tried to get into the Air Force Academy, and I didn't. And he advised me on how to get into West Point from the enlisted ranks. And so that was really beneficial to me. And it felt God was reaching out and touching me with his presence in my life at that particular point in time. And so after 2 years in the military as an enlisted man, I received an appointment to West Point and graduated from there with the class of 1968.
Wow. Well, we could probably talk the whole hour on your life at West Point, but can you kind of just give us a little bit of, you know, what life was like going through that and how your faith sustained you through that process? Because that is a rigorous 4 years of college and all the other stuff that's going through it. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
It is a rigorous program at West Point and very demanding of time. And I think that the minimum credits that I took in any one semester was like 18. And usually it was 20 or 21, 22 credits that we were required to take. And most colleges, if you're taking 12 and 15, you're kind of maxing out at 15. So we were always busy academically, but then, you know, every cadet had to participate in sports year round, and every cadet had to march in parades year round. And there was just all kinds of activities going on all of the time. And each year, freshman year, plebe year, was intense because of you're a plebe and there's all of these upperclassmen that are telling you what to do and when it's got to be done and all that sort of thing. So there's a fair amount of harassment that goes on in plebe year. And then from then on, it's just academics. You're just constantly studying and working. And it was a tough program, but I decided that I was going to stick it out and I was going to complete that program, and I did, and I'm very proud of that, and I think that my parents were very proud of what I did as well.
I can't imagine them not being. What I love about the crest, the West Point crest, is on one side of it, it says duty, honor, and country. And I just love that part of West Point. And I'm so proud that you are a West Point graduate. And just it's an incredible accomplishment. It really is. And we're going to go to a song now. And this is actually a Michael Martin Murphy song called My Country Under God.
My country under God, my country under God. I stand on land that's sacred ground. I'll not surrender or stand down. My country knows no king or crown. My country under God, my country under God, my country under God, where slaves were freed and free men tried, where my grandfathers broke the sod. No king shall ever run roughshod o'er my country under God. My country under God, my country under God. Though I be shackled, bound in chains, and though this ground may be bloodstained, it's here I shall always remain, in my country under God, my country under God. My country under God. My life, my liberty, my land are gifts to me from God's own hand. May His commandments always stand in my country under God.
Powerful song, man.
That is indeed. And, you know, I enjoy his voice and when what he does. That's very much so.
Absolutely. So now we have you graduated from West Point, and then you head off to Ranger School.
That's right. Most of my class attended Ranger School just shortly after we graduated. And in going to Ranger School, I was in the best physical condition of my life. And coming out of there, I was probably in the worst physical condition of my life. It was a physically demanding, very tough program, and it went on and on and on, it seemed like. But glad to be an Army Ranger, and glad that I went to that school, because it felt to me like what I learned there kept me alive later and kept my men alive. So I was Ranger school was the best, absolutely the best.
Well,
and the worst.
Elaborate a little bit about, I mean, you obviously aren't going to go into a lot of details, but elaborate a little bit on, you know, what a typical day of Ranger school is like, and how long does it last, and what goes on during that period? Because I didn't know. I was very interested to find out. I'm sure our listeners would like to know as well.
What goes on is that the instruction at Ranger School is trying to get you as close to combat without being in actual physical combat. And they do that by stressing you out in every way possible, including lack of sleep and lack of food, and just you go, go, go all of the time. You're on the go. There's 1 hour scheduled for sleep, and that's it. The rest of the time you're moving, you're going, and there's you're learning small unit tactics and what you need to be doing to keep yourself alive and keep your people alive that are with you, and it's just extremely mentally and physically demanding. Program lasts about 9 weeks, and it's nonstop.
Wow. So that intensive pace keeps up the entire 9 weeks?
Pretty much the entire 9 weeks, yes. There would be an occasion where we'd come out of the field for a day and then head back out. So we would get a good meal and a little bit of sleep, and off we go again. But it didn't happen very often. We went through mountain training, and went through jungle training, went through boat training on the coast of Florida. And so we were just in all kinds of weather. And quite frankly, I graduated in December from Ranger School, and my feet at that time were black because we were in water so much. Our feet were cold, and we were wet. And my feet were black, and they didn't really turn back to skin color until September of the following year. It just
wow.
It was very, very intense physically and very demanding. So it's one of those things. You just suck it up and drive on and keep on going until you finish. There are a lot of people that have to drop out because of they're not able to do it physically or mentally, but some of them get injured too, and they have to drop out. And if they drop out and they want to go back through the course, they have to start all over again. So,
wow.
It's a tough program, and I'm glad, I'm very, very glad that I attended that school.
Wow. Wow. So then after Ranger School, then you elected to go to Berlin before you went to Vietnam, correct?
Berlin was my first military assignment after Ranger School, after graduating from West Point, yes. And I had selected that. There was at West Point, they'd give you a choice of where you want to go for your first assignments. And I selected Berlin. I wanted to get some more experience under my belt before I went to Vietnam. Because I knew that Vietnam was calling and I'd be there sometime. And I wanted to just get more experience with troops and into the military and as an officer before I went to Vietnam.
Wow. Wow. And so when you were in Berlin, you weren't just working with troops. You want to tell us about a little bit about your duty in Berlin?
I was with troops initially. There were three battalions there and a tank company. This was when the wall was up around Berlin. This was in 69 and 70. And so it was a very exciting time to be there. It was still the Cold War was going on, and there were time periods where the Russians and the East Germans would shut down the passageways in and out of Berlin. Had a lot of exciting times of just the challenges of being 100 miles from West Germany, surrounded by a wall and surrounded by a lot of Russian and East German police and military personnel. It was a very exciting time to be there, and I loved the assignment. And after I was in the battalion for several months, then I was selected to be the aide-de-camp to the commanding general of Berlin Brigade, and I enjoyed that immensely as well. I got to see a lot of things that most people didn't get to see, because we were very, very active in the German community and seeing other things that were going on that I didn't see when I was in the battalion. It was a wonderful assignment. I enjoyed that immensely.
Well, some of my favorite stories you tell are the ones that when you go over to East Berlin and going through the checkpoints and taking the visitors, the general's daughter or whatever over there. I didn't even think about that. That never really crossed my mind how difficult and really precarious that could be to do that. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
It was precarious. We had to go through Checkpoint Charlie. Everybody's familiar with Checkpoint Charlie, I think, of our age in life. And as a military member there, I could just go through Checkpoint Charlie. You had to show some paperwork, but you didn't have to get out, be inspected, and your vehicle inspected. In fact, they could not do those things. And so it was easy for me to go through there. But for civilians, it was very, very difficult. They had to go through the checkpoint. They had to walk through it. And any money that they had to be turned into East German marks. And then when they came out, they had to donate whatever money they didn't spend to the East German Red Cross. But the incident you were talking about was the general's daughter and her friend were in college in the United States, and they came over at Christmas time. And the general had me escort the daughter's and the daughter's friend and his wife through the checkpoint there. And he said, do not let them, the girls, out of your sight. And so I had to get out of the vehicle and walk alongside the outside of the building and watch what they were doing through the glass there. And it was, I was not wanted to be there by the East Germans and the Russians. very intimidating, but the general section got to be there and watch them, and I did. And it was very exciting, very cold. But
really
we got them through okay, so it was good.
I love the story about some guests that you were escorting, and when they got to the point where they were going to have to turn in their money, all of their money, and they had a little more money on them than they should have. You want to tell about that?
One of my classmates from West Point had married a Greek girl from New Jersey, and the Greek family had restaurants in New Jersey, and they worked from Memorial Day until Labor Day, and then they traveled the world the rest of the year, and they called me. They were in Greece, and they called me and said, hey, can we come up and visit you? And they did. And so they visited, or took them over to East Germany, East Berlin. And just before we got to the checkpoint, I reminded them or told them that any money they had to exchange in East Marks and then donate back to the East German Red Cross when they came out. And they both looked at me, and they were carrying several thousand dollars in cash and traveler's checks. So fortunately, I had said that to them before they got to the checkpoint, and they gave me all of that money because I could walk through with it. But that was very interesting as well.
I do have to say I am enjoying a China hutch full of beautiful East German crystal and place servings and things that are just gorgeous that you had the good sense to purchase while you were stationed in Berlin. So that was pretty fun.
That was fun to be there. And fortunately, I had a West Point graduate that was my company commander when I first arrived in the battalion there. And he and his wife, his name is Bob Lins, and he and his wife showed me around and East Germany and where to buy the crystal and all of those things. And so it was nice.
Wow. Well, we're gonna listen to another song, and then when we come back, I would like to talk a little bit about your tour in Vietnam, and you know, kind of how your faith sustained you through that. That had to have been very harrowing, and we'd like to hear a little bit about that. But first, let's listen to "Hell in a Helmet" by R.W. Hampton.
That transport chopper's loading up to take us to the plane. Me and my boys are good as gone. After 7 months of living here and dying side by side, what's left of us is finally going home. Mom and Dad are waiting, big sis and brothers too, and I know what they'll expect to find. I don't want to disappoint them, but we just did our job. The heroes are the boys we left behind. We're hell in a helmet, and they call us justly so. We're fighting sons of bitches all the way. Put our faith in heaven and the ones that watch our backs. Devil dogs till our dying day. Marines till our dying day. I've tried hard to tell them it's not me that's coming home. At least not the me they used to know. And there's no way of explaining how I hate this dirty place, yet how I'm gonna miss it when I go. There's a pretty woman I will meet with a baby in her arms, born while my buddy was at war. Now how am I gonna tell her why I didn't bring him back? I've never known anything so hard. We're hell in a helmet, and they call us justly so. We're fighting sons of bitches all the way. We put our faith in heaven and the ones that watch our backs. Devil dogs till our dying day. Marines till our dying day. There's a girl who'd come to see me if I'd only call her up. Got a letter said, oh how I'm missing you. Could she ever love a fighting man with only half a heart? Half a heart that's broken right in two. So I'll take comfort in good whiskey, read my Bible and I'll pray. But my heart and soul's a half a world away. To those dusty streets and dope fields where my brothers bled and died, and where the better part of me must stay. We're hell in a helmet, and they call us justly so. We're fighting sons of bitches all the way. We put our faith in heaven and the ones that watch our backs. Devil dogs till our dying day. 12 choppers leaving now to take us to the plane. Me and my boys have loaded on, and after 7 months of living here and dying side by side, what's left of us is finally going home.
Wow. Well, I think that's kind of an appropriate song to lead us into this next segment of your life, which was heading to Vietnam. So I know you probably don't want to talk a lot about the details of that, but I do know after we were married, I was cleaning something out and I ran into, found a Purple Heart, and I went and I knew what that was for, and I went and asked you, you know, what did you get this for? And you said, so you must have been wounded. What happened? And you said, well, which time? So you have multiple Purple Hearts that I found out. You only told me about probably the least minor one of those injuries. And you just said, you're not going to tell me the rest of it. And I respect that. But I really would love to for you to talk a little bit, Bob, about going through that war and how your faith sustained you through that.
Well, let me first comment about that last song that you played. That's R.W. Hampton, and he wrote that in honor of his Marine son and
yes.
his son's buddies. And it's a powerful song, really, really, really powerful song, and I appreciate you playing that here. Yes, after my time in Berlin, I was assigned to Vietnam and to the 101st Airborne Division there. And I had the good fortune of commanding a rifle company in Vietnam, and I was honored to do that. I had some great troops in my company and in the battalion, and it was a pleasure and honor to be commanding those men. And even though they were a boy's age, they were men, and we spent most of our time in the jungle. Occasionally would rotate back out to a fire base and then be there for a week or so and then back out to the jungle again. It was time went fast and time went slow, and everybody was keeping track of you were assigned to Vietnam for a year, and everybody was keeping track of what day that they could get on the Freedom Bird and go back to the world, back to the United States. So,
wow.
I really believe that the training that I received at Ranger School served me well as a rifle company commander, and I very much appreciated that and always in the back of my mind was what I learned in Ranger School and applied that to as a company commander in Vietnam.
So did you find yourself reaching out with your faith to try to sustain you through that? Or is that something that was you felt distanced from during that time? I'm curious.
No, I can't say that I felt distanced from that from my faith at that time. My habit to say a little prayer every morning, and I did that then. But we had chaplains in the battalion, and they would come out on an occasional basis and provide a service, you know, Catholic or Protestant service to the troops. Generally, we were on a fire base, but occasionally it would be, we would, find a place that we could do that in the field that would be reasonably secure. When I heard the start of Hell in the Helmet and R.W. sings about the choppers coming and picked him up, my mind flashes not being picked up to go to the big plane to take you home, but we were air mobile, and so we were always getting on helicopters and being, that's the way they would move us around in the jungle and pick us up, go out, take us someplace, drop us off, it was just always helicopter sounds and smells and those things take me back to Vietnam really, really quickly.
Wow. I remember one incident that you shared with me, and I personally really feel like the Lord really sustained you and your unit through that. It was when you were told that there was going to actually bomb an area, you needed to get out of that area quickly, and the only way you could get out was not through the jungle, which would have been safer for you guys because you couldn't hack your way out fast enough to get far enough away. So you had to literally go down a river, I think is what you said. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's true. We had just been inserted into an LZ, a landing zone. The helicopters, we had the whole company there, and we hadn't even moved off. As soon as we got on the landing zone, we started, and everybody was there, we'd move off into the jungle and go on our missions. But we were still on there, and I got a call from headquarters and said that they were going to bomb the area with what's called an arc light. It was a B-52 strike, so they were way up in the clouds, and they were good pinpoint accuracy pretty much with those strikes, and it said that you had to move 3 kilometers from where you were and do it really fast, and it's just, you couldn't go through the jungle that way, and so we had to move along stream beds, and it was very, very risky to do that, and while we were moving, we found Pitt's helmet and the helmet that North Vietnamese soldiers wore, and we found some North Vietnamese money, and we found they made flip-flops out of old tires from trucks, and found some flip-flops like that, and so we moved very quickly and not very securely while we were doing that. And we made it as secure as we possibly could, but we managed to cover the distance and get hunkered down before the B-52 strike was put in.
Wow. And,
that was a nervous time. That was a really nervous
time. I can imagine. Well, you served your year and yet, go ahead.
And, you know, initially I was angry because the powers that be had just put us on that landing zone and said, bring the helicopter back in and take us out of here. And they had already committed those helicopters to somebody else, and so they didn't have those available. The only way we could get out of the, where we were was just hoof it. And that's the way we moved. We moved by foot mostly. Once the helicopters had dropped us off, then we're footbound.
Wow. I think you had all that marching under you from the Ranger School, huh? You had to do that really good. Oh, gosh. So you were in Vietnam for a year, and then when you got home from the war, you actually had a stint teaching at the Ranger School. And I would like for you to share what you taught at the Ranger School.
I was in Vietnam from September 70 to September 71. And prior to leaving Vietnam, I wrote a letter to the commanding general that was heading up the Ranger School and said I wanted to be assigned there because the training that I had received from there saved my life, saved my troops' lives. And, you know, it's the best small leadership program going. And so I wanted to go back and teach the skills that I knew and had and had used. So I wrote a letter to the commanding general and I showed up and was assigned to the ranger department and as an instructor. And I liked that. I felt like I was giving back to students information that I'd received when I went through ranger school. And I wanted them to know what I knew because it would keep them alive down the road.
Wow. Wow. Well, after Vietnam, you said you did something you told all of your troops not to do when they first got home. True?
That's true.
And what did you do?
I got married very quickly. I should not have done that. But I did. I got married very quickly. So it was not good for me. But I had a wonderful daughter out of that marriage, and I really love her dearly, and I'm so pleased about that.
So the marriage did not last, but. Your beautiful daughter Nicole was born, and one of the things that impressed me so much when we first met and started dating was the fact that in the process of that divorce, you fought for and secured custody of Nicole and went on to raise her alone. So tell us a little bit about that and how that affected your military career.
Well, that's exactly right. I did went through a custody battle over her and received custody and proudly raised her. And I'm proud of who she is today. She's a wonderful woman who's in a great marriage, some wonderful grandkids, and just loved her and them dearly, and I'm so pleased that I was able to provide some ongoing guidance and for her in her life as she was growing up. So, you started to say something?
Well, I just really would like for you to share, because it really impacted me about the character of your character and just your faith and your trust in the Lord and really striking out to raise her alone. And but shortly after you had received custody of her, you were actually deployed. Is that not correct?
Actually, no, it was sometime after that I was redeployed.
Okay.
But in raising Nicole, one of the things that I did when I was a youth, we were involved in the Methodist Church, and I was involved with the Methodist Youth Fellowship. And when Nicole and I moved to Northern California, I wanted her to experience the same type of a youth fellowship program that I had experienced as a child. And so we got very much involved with the church in Piedmont Community Church, and she was very much involved with the church as well and the youth program there, and she played in the bell choir and loved that immensely. And it set a great foundation for her Christian faith, and I was really pleased about that as well. So you mentioned deployment again. I was recalled to active duty. I stayed in the reserves and was recalled to active duty as an individual for Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And I was on active duty for almost a year during that time period, so from 90 to 91. And really enjoyed being back in the military. I had resigned my Army commission so that I could take care of Nicole, and that was something that I had to do because I couldn't see myself staying in the military. At that time, there were really no single parents in the military, and I couldn't see staying in the military and taken care of her. So I resigned my commission but stayed in reserve and got called back for Desert Storm. And I was really pleased to be called back. I enjoyed that work, and I was a lieutenant colonel at the time, and I was shortly thereafter promoted to colonel, and I think that promotion was due to my work in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and so I was really pleased that that would happen. And finally, after 40 years of active duty and reserve service to my country, in 2003, I think it was, I was told by the Army it was time to move on. So, retired from the Army, and I'm very, very pleased that I had a wonderful career in the military and just could not think of a better way of life for me. It worked out really well.
Wow. Well, I have no doubt in my mind that if you had stayed active military, you would have retired a general. So, I mean, that is your wife talking, but I know you, and I know your commitment and your dedication and just how bright you are. We're just brilliant, actually. So you have a beautiful, wonderful daughter to show for it and for that sacrifice and amazing grandchildren. And I really do love how grounded her family is in the Lord and in their church. And just it was definitely the best path to take. And I think you really did listen to the Lord's direction in that. And that was a wonderful thing, a wonderful gift to Nicole as well. So it was just so proud of you. So proud of you. There's a song that RW has that talks about a military man kind of talking to his family, and I really love it. And we're going to play that now, and it's called For the Freedom.
Gone from the Sangre de Cristos, the high country soon will be bare. As the cottonwoods bloom along the sleepy, slow Simo, oh, how I wished I was there. I'll bet Danny has grown a foot since I've been gone. Little Katie turns 7 this spring. Just hold 'em and kiss 'em and tell 'em I love 'em. For who knows what tomorrow might bring. Raise the stars and stripes for me every morning. Say a prayer. Please always remember, it's for the freedom we love that I fight. It's for the freedom we love that I fight. Got a letter from Dad, some cookies from Mama. Got the card that you sent yesterday. And I'll carry your picture in my left front pocket. Sort of helps me when I am afraid. Cause this desert's a hell when the wind blows the sand up. The nights here are black, cold, and long. But from what I can tell, that's why I'm singing this song. Raise the stars and stripes for me every morning. Say a prayer for me each night. Remember, please always remember it's for the freedom we love that I fight. It's for the freedom we love that I fight. The captain just came in and gave us our orders. I guess we'll be moving out soon. Just know that I love you, and if something should happen, you and the kids, dear, will know what to do. Raise the stars and stripes for me every morning. Say a prayer. Always remember it's for the freedom we love that I fight. It's for the freedom we love that I fight.
That's one of my favorite songs that he does. I really love that song. It's a good one. Oh, my goodness. Yep. Well, gosh, you're so much of your life that, you know, that you lived post-military, went on to get your doctorate in law and go into law, returned to your ranching roots, your from your grandpa's ranch, and got into horses and have taught and judged equestrian drill. And oh my gosh, there's so much to you that we just don't have time to get. So we'll have to just have you back on and talk about the horse stuff. That would be fun.
That would be a good idea. Yes, I'd like that.
So we'll have you back on and we'll talk about that, because there's some very cool stuff that came into your life, and you really developed and ran with that as well. And the best thing, as far as I'm concerned, is when the Lord brought us together. I was, of course, widowed and not looking, not dating, not even on my radar to do so. But God had other plans and just sort of inserted you into my life. And that was very cool. And you'd been single 19 years, I think, wasn't it, when we started dating?
Single a long time, and I give credit to Roy Rogers and Dale Evans and their granddaughter Julie Ashley and Robert Bob Sigmund for bringing the two of us together. I'm glad we're together, Faith.
I am too. I guess there's not a whole lot of people that can say that Roy Rogers and Dale Evans' granddaughter, you know, did a matchmaking job on them. She was pretty persistent about it too. Thank goodness. That's a whole nother story, but I just wanted to tell you again how deeply I appreciate you being on the show and how proud I am of you and of your service to this country and just how selfless and dedicated you are. And I feel incredibly blessed that I get to share the rest of your life with you. So thank you for being on the show.
It's been my pleasure. My darling wife, thank you for inviting me.
How could I not? Well, to just kind of close out this portion of the show with you, I could get really gushy, but I'm not going to do that. I do love this man, let me tell you. But we're going to go ahead and close with a cool song that RW has written just fairly recently, just kind of based on all the politics of our nation and kind of where it's at, which is kind of crazy right now. But I really do enjoy this song by RW called My Country's Not for Sale. And Bob, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
There's a trail of blood back through the sacred halls of history. Follow it back
where our fathers fought and died. Across the way, see the crosses on the hillside. On the wind, hear their voices as they cry. We've got to get back to the faith of our fathers and find our way back to the Liberty Bell and never forget that old flag and all she stands for. It's time to rise up and say this country is not for sale. She's not for sale. From Valley Forge they're calling, not for sale. From Gettysburg they cry. From Bella Wood to the battle for Fallujah, she's not for sale, no, not at any price. There was a time when we all stood together. There was a time when by fire we were tried. But we've lost our way. It's a way that costs so dearly. It's not too late to saddle up and ride. We've got to get back to the faith of our fathers and find our way back to the Liberty Bell and never forget that old flag and all she stands for. It's time to tell Washington my country's not for sale. From the Alamo to the sands of Iwo Jima, from Normandy to the Chosun Reservoir, back to Bataan, to the mighty Mekong Delta, from the Helmand Province to the Solomon's bloody shores, they cry. We gotta get back to the faith of our fathers.
I'm glad y'all are indulging me. It's just it's so wonderful to get to share my wonderful husband with y'all. And I know this is not the 4th of July or Veterans Day, you know, not the normal time when we do a patriotic show, but I truly believe that our veterans and servicemen and women are some of our most self-sacrificing and precious citizens. And they need to be honored and appreciated every single day of our lives. And something that really impressed me when I was able to attend a West Point reunion with Bob was when they read the West Point Cadet Prayer at a memorial service that they have at every reunion that honors West Point, their classmates who they've lost. They go all the way back to Vietnam and all the way forward, and you know, their classmates who are no longer with us. And it was a wonderful service. And they read that cadet prayer, and I was just, it just really kind of blew me away. I had no idea that one even existed. And in researching it a little bit to talk about it for this show, I found this great piece on it that I'd just like to read to you, kind of talking about what that cadet prayer is all about. And this says, the nature of war is hellish precisely because it is rooted in things like fear, hatred, and revenge. Even when one is on the noble side of a war, the side that is defending itself against the active and persistent threat of violence and potential tyranny can be caught up in the horrors of war and can be tempted to do things that are not morally acceptable by any calculation. The true warrior, then, must be one who knows the limits of behavior that morality places on each of us. He or she must be humble enough and courageous enough to refuse to deny those moral limitations, even in the heat of battle. No human being can do this on his or her own. A truly humble warrior knows that he or she is dependent on a higher power for that strength. This is why the cadet prayer at West Point is so important. It focuses the minds of our future military officers on what is most important, on the moral demands of life as a military officer. It recognizes the necessity of appealing to one who can provide the graces needed to be a good soldier, a good officer, person. I love that. And I would love to read to you all now the cadet prayer. Our God, our Father, thou searcher of human hearts, help us to draw near to thee in sincerity and truth. May our religion be filled with gladness, and may our worship of thee be natural. Strengthen and increase our admiration for honest dealing and clean thinking, and suffer not our hatred of hypocrisy and pretense ever to diminish. Encourage us in our endeavor to live above the common level of life. Make us to choose the harder right instead of the easier wrong, and never to be content with a half-truth when the whole can be won. Endow us with courage that is born of loyalty to all that is noble and worthy, that scorns to compromise with vice and injustice, and knows no fear when truth and right are in jeopardy. Guard us against flippancy and irreverence in the sacrifice things of life. Test new ties of friendship and new opportunities of service. Kindle our hearts in fellowship and those of a cheerful countenance, and soften our hearts with sympathy for those who sorrow and suffer. Help us to maintain the honor of the Corps, untarnished and unsullied, and to show forth in our lives the ideals of West Point in doing our duty to thee and to our country, all of which we ask in the name of the great friend and master of all. Amen. Our extraordinary country, the one they have fought and died for in the midst of this terrible struggle, faces enormous challenges. Our military is willing to and have died to preserve and defend this great nation. And the very least we can do is pray for not only them and their endeavors, but for this great nation as well. And in fact, the Lord calls us to do that. So I would like to close with these scriptures. The first is in Chronicles 7:14. If my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sins and heal their land. And the last one is in 1 Timothy 2:1-3. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is a good and it is pleasing in the sight of God, our Savior. Well, that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Bob, for joining us, and to Gary for the amazing job he always does producing this show. And please remember that there are several wonderful shows on Equestrian Legacy Radio. All of them are archived, so you can go back and listen to them whenever it is convenient for you. So please tell your friends about us, and you can even like us on Facebook at Equestrian Legacy Radio. So until next week, I wish you blessed trails.
We have wakened a sleeping giant, said an admiral of Japan, when bombs from their air armada exploded on our land to draw us into a dreadful war that circled all the earth. And once again, the awesome strength of America saw rebirth. Of a thing called dedication to a simple word, free, that became the basic force in this land of liberty. The dark forces of the world brought terror everywhere, nation after nation fell into misery and despair. An iron curtain ring their lands to deaden hope and pride. They stared out on their ravaged land where countless masses died. Before the tyranny of those who felt it was their given right to brutally impose their will upon those who had lost their will to fight. And much of the world fell to that darkness to live where there was no light. A wall was built to keep apart the free man from the slave. And many of those from behind that wall found an early grave in their attempts to find freedom. They knew somewhere was there. For the voice of America was always in the air they breathed. And from it they took heart, knowing that in that great land they would always be a part of that swelling cry for freedom, that no darkness could befall. For America never wavered in her pledge to one and all, to stand by her conviction that no man could be free until all men live in a peaceful world where there is no tyranny. And so the walls came tumbling down. The great light lit up the night. The sleeping giant never slept and never gave up the fight that began at Concord in 76. And for more than 200 years, steadfastly kept the lamp alive through blood and sweat and tears. Should America fail, the world would fail. If we should lose our light, the world would plunge to darkness, to endless, timeless night. God bless America. Freedom never sleeps.